see you.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey. I like his shoes.
Thank you.
Ooh, thank you. These are new. Those are good. Yeah.
What's that?
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. I bet if you saw Joel's closet of shoes and mine, there'd be a market difference.
Thank you.
So Anthony was telling us you have such an unorthodox way of writing. You're coming up with great ideas for scenes, stacking them up, and then finding a way to fit them into a movie. I mean, can you talk about that?
Yeah, what we do is we take a feeling we want to achieve, or even certain images that we say, boy, those would be great if you had a stew that included all of those images. And then what you look for, I think, is an armature, which is a plot that's loose, that's interesting enough to generate a mystery, but loose enough that you can sort of use it as a frame and then hang stuff on. And also that gives you variation and room to move from being very light or colorful to, you know, maybe getting a little darker, melancholy in points too. We look for something that just lets us get the most flavors. And yeah, there are some things we'll finish the script and go, God, I wish we could have used that one scene. And we just couldn't fit it, you know.
It sounds very time consuming. I wonder when you're working on something like Iron Man, when you have the studio on you and time limit, say, do you get any sleep?
No, I mean, that's the thing I would stress, which I think a lot of people don't. Writers, they kind of work hard, and I like that people know that because, you know, I know relatives who call up, yeah, well, you're in Hollywood. I mean, you know, you get all this money and, you know, you sit on your bed full of $100. But I don't have a mattress full of $100. It's not full of money. It's full of foam. But they assume that there's this sort of just like people assume that in my library there's not hundreds of books of Edwardian ghost stories that I read late at night. They think there's just some blonde sitting on a shelf lighting my cigar for me, you know. I think you could have both. No, I so writing's tough. It's insanely obsessive work. And once you commit to it, you're screwed. When you dance around it and don't start yet, it's painful but okay. But once you start and you go, oh, man, I just realized this could be really good. Now you're on the hook because you sense it. You know it can be good. And you're, oh, hell, now I got to catch the whole damn thing. You know, it's like digging and you want to stop digging, but then you see there's gold down there. And you go, got to get it.
And Joel, what was it about the script that you thought this is a...
I mean, look, I've known Shane for 30 years. We met in 86 when he wrote, he was 21 years old out of UCLA when he wrote Lethal Weapon. And, you know, we had a long, you know, relationship that was, mm-hmm. that, you know, was colorful and exciting. I mean, we did Last Boy Scout in 91, and then he had a kind of a period of introspection. And then we did Kiss Kiss in 2005. And then, you know, he had written Nice Guys before we made Kiss Kiss. And it just had kind of, we didn't know what to do with it. It we talked about maybe doing it as a television series or trying to do it as something. We didn't really know what to do. And after Iron Man, in 2003, he came back to it and said, look, you know, I want to try to do it now. And it had become the 70s story. It had become a different kind of his material. And the thing about it that's so incredible is it is a mystery. It is a thriller, but it's just very funny. It's really funny. It's his voice. It's his singular voice, which makes it so effective. And once he said, I wanted to do it, and we came to a point where, you know, people were looking and saying, what do you want to do? This came together and we made it.
Did you know what you wanted Russell? Because I know Russell was the first one to be attached to it. Did you know you wanted him immediately?
It's the process of Hollywood that sometimes works very well. I mean, he's a client of William Morris, WME, and George Freeman, who's Russell's agent, is at WME, and the script was there. And he said, do you think you'd want Russell to do this? And we said, Russell Crowe? And he goes, yeah. He says, he wants to do something like this. It really, he wants to do this kind of movie? And I said, yeah, he would like to do it. And he'd like to see Shane. So Shane was literally on his way there when I called Ryan's manager, a girl named Eileen Feldman. I said, what is Ryan doing now? He says, well, he's available. I said, well, let me send you a script. So by the time he got to meeting with Russell, he could say, well, what about doing with Ryan? And it was quick.
Yeah, Russell told us that story.
Yeah, and each of those guys, by the way, I talked to Ryan even briefly, and he said, you know, if you could get Russell Crowe, that would be... And Russell Crowe, of course. So really, it's the most effortless deal ever. I said, I want $20 for this. He goes, well, unfortunately, we only have $20 to give you. Oh, well, done, you know. And so that was that.
Now, what was... Russell got a list of talent. And he was like, I'm not going to make this
I didn't see the list. It was his damn list. I don't even know who generated this list. It almost screwed us up, you know? I want to track these people down, you know?
He knows who's on the list.
I mean, I had a movie together with Ryan at one point that didn't get made. I was going to make Logan's Run with Ryan, so we had made a deal and we had spent time together, and it just didn't happen. But I believe in him, and I believed in him, and he's a have you talked to him yet? Has he been here yet?
Yes.
He's a fantastic guy. He's funny, smart, a real deal.
A gentleman. Yeah. He's a gentleman.
Smart. I mean, gets it. Been doing this forever. I mean, they found him. I don't know how old he was when he did the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, he's 10 years old or whatever. So we're doing it a long time. And when this came about, I mean, you know, when we, you know, we said, is there a chance he would do this? And she said, yeah, he read the script and wants to do it. I mean, it's like, look, for, you know, people always say to me, what's your job like? What's your producer's job? I said, look, I wake up in the morning, people say no to me. That's my job. And if I get, you know, 2 yeses and 3,000 no's, I mean, that's a day for me. If I get 1 yes, I'm lucky. And you know, when somebody says I want to do that, it's a great day, and it just, you know, it's kismet. I mean, it just came together. I mean, and who would have thought that these two very serious, very kind of, you know, well respected dramatic actors would want to take on this mantle of his voice and play these roles? And when you watch the movie, it's just, I mean, you can play the audience like an orchestra. Yeah. I mean, they're with them. They're in there, right in there, on their, they're on the court. They're passing the basketball. They hit they're dunking the. I mean, it's all happening, and it's right there, and you see it, and you know, the audience is just in heaven. That's what I've seen.
Well, yeah, I'm very much aware of and in love with the way these two guys, you know, they make this sort of a tasting menu of all the different comedy things that they can hit and all these different moments, and. If you throw in enough of those moments, what I love is that you can't remember all of them. So you watch the movie, and you have to go back a second time to catch all the. Oh yeah, I remember that. That was funny. You know, I can't keep track because they did so many little things, and I would have been a fool not to have taken their input, by the way, and the things they thought they wanted to bring to it or add. And I'm happy to take credit for them, by the way. You know, I won't tell you what it was.
Just a question for you, though. That house where the house party was?
It was in Atlanta. I mean, the funny thing about this movie is here, this is where we are in our lives today. A lot of the early movies that I made, action movies I made, like Die Hard and Lethal, and I mean, they were made in L.A., you know. Mm-hmm. But we can't do that anymore, really, because we just need these rebates. So the movie's made in Atlanta. I mean, we shot this L.A. 1977 movie in Atlanta. Now, we did shoot 3 weeks here, but the same price, 3 weeks, cost 8 weeks in Atlanta. So that house is in Atlanta, and it was owned by a kind of music impresario guy who has it. I mean, they shot a lot of music videos in it. But it's surrounded by trees, so you really can't even see it. Right. And in our movie, it's in Bel Air, and the whole city is out around it. You know, and. I mean, it feels like it should be in L.A. I mean, so much of... Look, some of the big vistas that we, you know, took out buildings that shouldn't be there, and we put in smog, and we made it look like, you know, the 70s. But, you know, so much of that stuff is shot in Atlanta. One of the magazines, I think, in the U.K., they wanted an article about all the kind of L.A. locations, and they sent us, you know... A story, yeah. With all these pictures, and I said every one of those shots are in Atlanta.
Yeah, I know.
They're not LA locations, but there are plenty of things.
We did photograph things in LA that entered those locations. Yeah. I'm sorry, are you wearing a? I was looking. This says "fuck off" on your person. Okay, just checking. I'm sorry. By the way, never mind.
Look, she's going.
Okay.
It's been complicated. Well, it's this guy named Brett Taney worked for me. I mean, the building was a great building. It was designed, you know, during the WPA, and this guy Louis Simon was the architect, and it was built in 1939. But we're getting there. It's complicated.
Is it safe to say that for your pet projects, you're in love with Los Angeles and Australian leading men?
You know, the Australian leading men, it's funny because what you do get a lot from Australia, it seems like, is forget the word leading and just emphasize the word men, which a lot of the sort of tough guys of the past, the Lee Marvins, the John Cassavetes, they sort of gone by the wayside. So, I came up with that era and that kind of, even in fiction, the heroes on the front covers of these sort of tawdry paperback novels. They don't resemble boys. They're more these sorts of archetypal men. And I think Australia's pretty decent. If you look at the actors come out of there, they're pretty rough. They have a pretty good track record at approaching the Cassavetes quotient, shall we say.
Yeah, I think of Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, yeah.
About that, I mean, is it hard? I can't remember the last time we saw a film noir. It's a film noir comedy, granted, but under the studio banner.
It's tough. There's Private Eye movies are my favorite. We tried on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and that was Warner Brothers. But you know, it performed enough that it didn't lose money, but it sure didn't perform enough that it made money. So you know, once again, at the time we were trounced by the Dukes of Hazzard, which had these, you know, Jessica Simpson. We had Robert Downey when he was, you know, a little rough. Just got out of whatever, the Pokey, and we had Val Kilmer when he was at a low point in his career. So what are you going to do? You know, it didn't do well, but it was a good movie, and I'll keep going back to that well. I can make detective films the rest of my life, and I want to bring it. And by the way, please, feel free to help. If you want to see more detective movies, here's one. In the middle of all this sort of branded summer competition, largely with cape-wearing people. So if you think that you want to see guys with ties instead of guys with capes, you can probably help us out a little bit here.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, we had a good shot with Kiss Kiss, but this really is the real deal. I mean, it's a good budget, two big movie stars. It's a good story. I mean, it really works. It's fun. It's really fun. And look, I mean, it's a question of, you know, It's a challenging time because, I mean, we're surrounded by these big... I mean, Captain America's going to make a fortune this weekend. Right after us is going to be X-Men. I mean,
yeah.
But look, it's summer playing time. We should be able to... If we can get an audience, we can keep them. You know, that we know they'll like the movie has playability. We just got to get them in the theater. Right. Right.
And it looks like you're going for a sequel. I mean, that end. Quick,
pull her arm. twist it.
The reality is this, that, you know, when we started doing these sequels, I mean, they killed us. I mean, when I started making these movies, they just were so, the media, everybody was so negative on the idea of sequel-type movies. Everybody made fun of them. And now, look, people like serial fiction. They always liked serial fiction. I mean, like John Wayne, he was a franchise on his own. I mean, his movies were all kind of the same movies, but they were not sequels. They were just, he was the franchise.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know,
yeah.
but you know, when you make these movies, I mean, I didn't make Lethal Weapon thinking we'd have a sequel. Die Hard, I think it'd be a sequel. I mean, we didn't think of that. I mean, yes, Sherlock Holmes is 100 books, so we can do that. But, you know, but look, you know, these guys, and we've got two great actors in characters that they love. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, do we want to continue the story? Wouldn't that be great? But I can't worry about it. We just worry about...
We're not in the results business.
Yeah.
We did our job. We swept up, you know, our side of the street. Now, whatever results come our way, that's...
Why did you reset in the 70s? I mean, I understood it wasn't originally set in the 70s. And actually watching it, I was like, this doesn't... I guess the porn thing. Yeah, it's very much tied to
But there's no cell phones, and it's a very different world at that time. It's a very different type of world, you know?
And also, there's a timelessness, I think, that's really effective in detective movies. Even going back to, you know, Chinatown, for instance, opened a window onto this era in the 30s where you had the San Gabriel Valley and the water rights and the land grab, and that was really effective. The 70s offered us a really decrepit sort of dime store chic version of L.A. I mean, was it still the destination, the end game for all the American dreamers? Yes, it was the coast. It was L.A., but the Hollywood sign was in tatters. The sky was filled with smog. You know, there were even air raid type sirens which would go off in L.A. I don't know if you remember.
No, I came in 92.
Yeah. No, they would say, take your kids indoors because they shouldn't be playing ball until after 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Like, China.
Good Lord, you know. Yeah, or Mexico City or whatever you want to fill in.
Mm-hmm.
And even Hollywood Boulevard was sort of a porno cesspit with every other storefront being XXX.
Sure.
So into that environment, that sort of faded glory, it's like picture some old, you know, prom queen standing there saying, come to L.A., but her dress is, you know, hanging in tatters and her, you know, face is starting to show lines and wrinkles. This was the sort of faded glory city back in the 70s that was the modern Sodom and Gomorrah, for which a detective story is perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.